Can I just weigh in?
Sure.
Fiona, I just want to clarify. So the argument that there has been increase in concentration, which was in a 2016 Council of Economic Advisors report, has been used as the justification for saying
I mean, not in my field. Not in my field. I think PhD economists generally in IO are concerned about market power and markups and competition and not the size of the company.
Yes.
Right, but the problem is...
Politically, in Congress and in the public debate, that has been pointed to as evidence that, you know, you read The Economist, you know, our article that kind of kicked a lot of this off, and that's exactly what they're saying. So I may agree with you for economists, but it's something that has been used as a justification and almost a, sort of like evidence antitrust laws aren't working.
Yeah, but then I would say anyone who understands that shouldn't open the conversation with a discussion of concentration, because, like, nobody, why should any of us be talking about that if we all understand that it's not the relevant issue?
Well, the problem is that you somehow have to bridge from, for example, the discussions in the presidential election to, you know, reality. And I suppose that may be an oxymoron, but, you know, there's some, you know, necessity to try to do that. But anyway, Bill?
And I can't think of the moment of an effective way to have that conversation with legislators in a way that drives that home, because they're setting expectations that are based on a set of assumptions that we wouldn't accept. But that, when they demand action, intervention, those are the assumptions they bring to you. And how do you do the education with them? I've not figured that out, but that's a problem in a lot of jurisdictions where they're focused on one thing, and you try and say, that's not what you should be worried about. You should be worried about something else. And I think, I do think the UK preliminary report is a very effective diagnosis of a number of problems. I'd start with that. They went about it with a way knowing that there were a lot of other studies out there, and the question for them was, what can we add that's not out there? I think they did it quite skillfully, with more work to come. And on remedies, the correct approach, I think, is to ask what was the problem and what set of solutions is best suited to it. Some of those might involve conduct. I think, again, of the CMA's work using this market investigation reference tool, where in a number of instances it's been a mix of all of these. Some of them involve disclosure, focusing on consumer behavior, how to make changes on the demand side. Some of them have structural consequences, some powerfully structural, like the reorganization of the ownership of the British airports that serve London. I do think that in our field, there is a painful inadequacy of knowledge about former enforcement episodes and to determine carefully exactly how the intervention affected behavior. Sometimes the fact of the lawsuit did the trick. I'm convinced in my conversations with former and current Microsoft employees that Microsoft decided not to use the platform to use Windows to forestall Google and others. They could have fought back. They didn't do it. But in other instances, I think painfully, we found out it takes a long time to know what works. The remedy in the AT&T Western Electric case, from the case started in 1949, settled in 1956, the remedy sought was to divest Western Electric from AT&T. That didn't happen. AT&T's IP, Bell Labs in particular, was put in the public domain. At the time, that was ridiculed as being desperately inadequate. Terrible, political sellout. Congress had hearings to see whether or not the White House sold out the case. Now, that's regarded as a key foundation for the digital age. In a lot of ways, very humbly, you don't know. But what we could do is spend a lot more time looking at past episodes in more detail to try to get a better idea of what worked and the extent to which the presence and the bringing of the case itself motivated changes in the sector.
Mike?
Yes, I feel maybe compelled to defend the political process as the one who spent 2.5 years working for Senator Klobuchar.
What's she up to?
She's not returning my phone calls. I don't understand why.
You in particular, she should.
And I was going to say something nice about
no,
you.
No, it should.
So, you know, I think there is a tendency amongst lawyers, particularly or academics, to disparage the political process. And that's fine. It's fair. We've been doing it for 250-some-odd years. And the Western civilization's been doing it, and they did it back in ancient Greece and in ancient Rome. But that's kind of that's not unique to this issue. It occurs on every issue. And sometimes things get done. Sometimes very important things get done. Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, the Clean Air Act. So, yeah, it's hard to talk to politicians because they are looking at 1,800 things and they're constantly simplifying it. But I think that's true, but that's the world we live in, and it's better than all the other alternatives, summing up the Winston Churchill quote. On the concentration issue, I mean, I guess the way I want to just add a little bit of color. Back in January, I moderated a panel at the big economic conference. Fiona was on it. Professor Nancy Rose at MIT was on it, and then Professor Jan DeLoker was on it, and he's the guy, one of the co-authors of the first big markup papers. Okay, like it's called "Markups and Monopoly Power." And then Professor Van Rienen from MIT was on it, and he's on what's called the Superstar Firm paper. So this is the one. So on the left, everyone likes DeLoker's paper because it says we have a problem, and everyone on the right tends to say, oh, the Superstar Firm is the paper that matters because it says all this increase in markup is all due to competition. If you were in there, you would have realized that across the board there was broad consensus. Number one, that yes, the markups tell us something has dramatically changed in the economy. Two, none of the macro studies on either side of the issue are going to be able to prove causation. Three, that despite that uncertainty, everyone said there's a competition problem. Four, the lack of certainty isn't a reason to act. So I get you can be really upset with all the people citing all the various concentration numbers, but let's remember, what's coming out of the academy of the IO economists is there's a problem and we need to do something. And when we look at Section 2 law, what do we see? Right, you have between Trinco and Credit Suisse, there's a real question at this point, right? Could the government break up AT&T under that case law? AT&T was MCI's basic claim was a refusal to deal claim, and they were operating in a very highly regulated industry. And so this is not my argument. It's Howard Schlansky's. I will give him credit. And if you don't like it, you can blame him. But if you like it, then you can give me credit for recognizing it. The second part, so there's the doctrinal problem in going after exclusionary conduct. Second, economically, we now have markets that are with high network effects, winner take all, which means we should be more concerned about unilateral conduct than we were in the 80s. Because what the point is, once you win the market, you have the ability, a much greater ability to affect competition going forward, but we have the substantive problem. Point three, agreeing with Bill on the problems with where we stand, right now, the cynicism he expressed to the political process, the most likely changes to current antitrust policy are going the wrong way, right? The SEC almost certainly is going to lose its ability to seek disgorgement. That will almost certainly lead to the FTC losing its ability. There is talk of unitary executive, delegation authority. No. All of that, those are far more likely to occur in the near future and would basically render both agencies incapable of deterring conduct. Because if all the FTC and the DOJ... Oh, so that's it. I'll get off the soapbox.
Okay. Let me give everybody a couple minutes, but I would like to return to one part of my question, and you know, starting with Maureen here, is there some Section 2 cases that you would bring? I mean, there are a lot of investigations going on now. We've heard a lot about the inadequacies, so.
I'm not going to identify cases. Like, against particular companies, but one case that I was supportive of and took some heat for supporting was the McMahon case that the FTC brought, right? So it was an exclusionary conduct case where a company with market power was able to lock up all the distributors and they raised prices. And I thought that was a very important case that the FTC brought and eventually won in the 11th Circuit. So I agree with a lot of what Michael said, focused on where we know there's a competitive problem, we shouldn't shy away from using the tools that the laws have given us. And I think it's important to continue to focus on detecting those. So in the McMahon case, when you look back to the D.C. Circuit decision in Microsoft, there's Dentsply that DOJ brought in the Third Circuit. I mean, there's some very good case law to build on, I think, in that line of cases. So that's one that I think gets a little bit overlooked because it wasn't in a tech area, right? It had to do with pipes for water projects, not a particularly sexy area, but I think the reasoning in that case was very strong and should be looked at carefully for a lot of the issues that people are concerned about.
Fiona?
What you're asking is a hard thing because unless a person is on the inside looking at discovery, you can't really ever know what the merits of a particular case are. And if you're on the inside looking at discovery, you can't be on a panel like this talking about it. So that's an inherent barrier. I would say that looking at the record in Europe on the Google cases, I think those generate enough concern that I'm really surprised that we don't have more action in that area in the United States. I think the leaked document that the FTC supposedly had that showed that Mark Zuckerberg said that he was acquiring Instagram because it was a competitor of Facebook, that makes me feel like that acquisition might need to be looked at again, along with some other conduct in that area. So there's plenty to do. I think the issue is really what Michael's identified, which is that if you found harm and you found consumers not benefiting from competition because of the behaviors of these platforms, would any court be willing to rule that conduct a violation of a law? I think that's the problem we've got. And that feeds back to the agencies being unwilling to bring such a case because they're afraid they're going to lose. And the consumer loses out in that dynamic because the consumer is interested in having competition to give her innovation and quality and good prices.
Bill?
I think you can still do good cases and win, but you need a carefully thought out process of what the high ground is and how you're going to pursue it. I think, by the way, you still win the AT&T case today because there you had a concession by the Federal Communications Commission that it was overwhelmed. Their views were asked. And crucial in Trinco is the assumption that the regulatory process is in some sense effective. The FCC was asked, said, what do you think? They said, we have a lot of nominal tools, but AT&T runs circles around us. So, I think with those facts, you still win that case. But as Maureen was saying, you need an inventory of matters that are based on your having a strategy. And ideally, that should be a strategy between the commission and the department. And I don't think that's going to happen in anybody's lifetime in this room. That's not going to happen. That is such a bitter, unfortunate relationship that's not going to be a genuine collaboration. It should be. But it won't. So we're going to have unilateral decision making, but that's to start with a strategy of what cases, and not just tech cases. Small cases make big law. Lorraine Journal was a small case involving a radio station and a newspaper in northern Ohio. Otter Tail was a relatively trivial case based in terms of its impact. You should be looking for the foundations of cases that become the principles, the tools that you can use in other matters. And that's based on looking back at what's worked in the past and how it works. So I think you can still build a program going ahead. I can think of things there where I wish the FTC had prevailed. I think in a just world, we would have won Rambus. We were affirmed by the wrong court. Third Circuit affirmed the outcome in Broadcom. Things would have been much different. Last, I think it would be very useful to look for the agencies in deciding what the risk appetite ought to be at all of the decisions taken over the past decade not to act. The department did not bring cases. Why? Was it risk aversion? The commission walked away from Google. Why? To have more of a deliberative process to think about why were those decisions taken and what does that tell us about the appetite for risk in the future?
So let me stick up for the agencies a little bit here, because we talked about their limited budgets. We talked about the growth of the economy. They have to set priorities, too, right? So, like, for example, the FTC has invested a lot in healthcare competition. We talked about the hospital merger retrospective. I don't think that the activist pay for delay case was an easy case that was easy to win, right? And I think the agency stuck with that all the way up to the Supreme Court after it lost in almost any circuit. So I take with a grain of salt the idea that, you know, I don't, you know, I didn't work at the DOJ. I'm not as intimately involved in that, but at the FTC, you know, there were cases that the agency brought and they weren't, you know, easy and they weren't able, you know, to win them necessarily. You think about the Steris case, which was an actual potential competition case. But, you know, the agencies are trying, in my mind, to focus on things where, you know, do this balance of important cases, but also where the consumer harm is more clear, more evident. You know, I think consumers today are probably, you know, saying more about concerns about healthcare costs than about online issues, too. And the agencies need to be responsive to that. I know academically and politically, there is a big focus on the tech space, but I also wonder if that's what your average consumer is really raising concerns about.
Mike?
Yeah, so I hear what you're saying, Bill, on AT&T. However, AT&T would also say, we have never dealt with MCI. We don't interconnect anybody. Under Trinco, we have an absolute right to refuse to deal with our competitors.
There, AT&T, there's evidence in the record that AT&T had engaged in other behavior to create incompatibilities.
Okay, but I think the larger point here is we can sit here and have this conversation, and we shouldn't be able to have that conversation. That, I think, is the issue. But
I think if we do the heavy lifting, there's a way to the summit. It's a hard climb, but you can do it, and I wouldn't give up.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying, but we shouldn't be in that world.
It should be an easy climb.
And so... And where that
I should be in the NBA too, but you know it's
so. Does that count against my time or?
Yes.
You can have some more time here, Mike. You can get back on your soapbox if you want.
So I think when you right, so you asked what kind of cases, and I agree. I have a hard time sort of picking on companies when I haven't been on the inside. I do think, which should not be a surprise, the government should be looking to be pushed back on Trinco. I think Trinco is too broad, particularly in the Second Circuit, and it stands as a barrier to important, and it now protects what could be very problematic conduct. Similarly, I think when you look at where the research is, the loyalty rebates, I think there's a lot of now research about the ways in which those can be anti-competitive. I think the agency needs to look at that. These are the tools that we would expect based on the literature for monopolists to use. Same with the MFNs, most favored nation cases. And so that's where I think they need to go. And I think I agree with Bill that you can still do something. And I think the model here we've referred to a little bit, one was what Tim did back when he was chairman, where it was, okay, I don't like where we are in hospital mergers. Let's study the issue. Let's generate a lot of evidence. And then let's pick a case, like, where let's find the merger where we can prove the effect and let's bring it internally so that we can rely on the institutional expertise of the commission. And that was how you turned things around. It took a long time. I think by the time that case was decided, you had long since moved on. The FTC applied a similar approach on the patent settlements. So I think that's the two parts. Those are the types of cases I would be looking for. And two, you do have to sort of have, as Bill says, a strategic plan about how you're going to attack it. It's not just go file a complaint and hope that the court says, okay, we think you're right, because I think the government starts in a hole on Section 2 at this point.
I mean, Tim, the other example that goes back to December, January 2000 and 2001, where we met in this building in the spring and said, what's broken that we have to work on? One of the broken tools was the rule of reason coming out of California Dental. And a concerted strategy is we're going to find cases to repair it, to bring a truncated method of analysis back into focus. PolyGram was part of that. Texas, physician's case was another. Real Comp was another. That is three matters that generated important Court of Appeals decisions to try to correct, I think, some of the oversights that were in the case. But I think the point is, and Michael and I agree on this, it doesn't happen by accident. And you've got to have a conscious process of deciding where you want to go.
We've got about 20 minutes left. We haven't talked much about mergers, so let me give each panelist a few minutes to talk about the current state of merger policy and what they would change. We've had, for example, there have been four data releases by the agencies, the last one in the FTC, the Obama administration, in 2011, which detailed various metrics, one of which showed that the marginal merger, the one that was roughly 50% sued and 50% not, were, this is based on second requests, was when there were, it was a 4-3 merger, and there were all sorts of other issues. But in any event, what would you do, change, keep the same about merger policy? Let me start with Bill.
And this is, in many ways, the result of work done with Bob Marshall, Leslie Marks, and Mike Moyer. I would expand the attention to coordinated effects theories in the zone of 6-5 or 5-4. I think there's a lot of evidence that suggests that firms, in many instances, are pretty good at figuring things out at that realm. And in particular, a firm that's got a cartel history, I would almost adopt a presumption that you can't buy somebody in the same sector. And I'd be wary of your vertical acquisitions, too. I would use, in a much more systematic way, our past experience with enforcement. Agencies are sitting on what might be called big antitrust data. They have it. There's a large body of information that deals with past enforcement, past remedies. It's not joined up very well. So one of my main pitches would be that the coordinated effects approach would be expanded. In our experience, it would have been a more effective litigation, perhaps, of Arch Cole. But I think there is a lot of reason to be more suspicious and concerned with transactions that reduce the number of market participants to five or four players. And there again, I'd be looking for cases where I'd go into court and try to pursue them. And yes, I'd have it all out all the way up to the Supreme Court. Justice Breyer, at an event we had over at GW, said, we'd love to do another merger case, but we can't create one on our own. So if I had setbacks, I'd take one up. But one of my priorities would be coordinated effects that builds on what we've learned in the cartel enforcement area about what firms do, how they do it. And I'd be looking for a case in that band to push the frontier out there.
Fiona?
I think we've strayed a lot from the basic economics of a horizontal merger, which is that all horizontal mergers cause harm if they don't have efficiencies, right? You write down any kind of ordinary Bertrand or Cournot model, and that's what you're going to get. 10-9 creates less harm than 3-2, but they all create harm. So I think it would be appropriate to revisit the law and just flip the burden and say, look, if you want to merge with a competitor, come to the agencies and explain what's good about your merger. And if you're 10 to 9, it's not going to be very hard. If you're 3 to 2, it's going to be a lot harder. And that would save agency resources, and it would put the burden on the parties that actually know what they're going to do by way of efficiencies and how they're going to achieve it and so forth. And the second thing I would put in such legislation would be for Congress to tell the courts that in antitrust, the unit of analysis is the company. So we're interested in working out whether one company is going to compete with another company. And we've had a distressing run of cases where the executive testimony is taken as useful by courts without verification. So I think you really need to instruct courts that the executive testimony gets zero weight unless there's a verified basis for it. And that's particularly important because if you're going to throw away the company and look at the executive and say, well, they say they're going to keep competing, so that seems fine with me, the consumer doesn't have a CEO in that room, right? The parties have a CEO, but the consumer doesn't have a CEO. So if you do it that way, you basically are saying everyone can merge. And that's I think is of concern because that doesn't seem like it's hewing to the facts of the transaction. So I would change the burden and I would be more careful about evidence efficiencies being verifiable.
Maureen.
So I'm just going to make a very practical point that the cases are expensive to litigate. And so, at least speaking from my experience at the FTC, I would give the agency more money for experts, right? So many of the...
I just got you a billion, Maureen,
thank
so
you.
Every year.
I'm not, right, there you go.
That's in the bank.
Because often when there's discussion, it's like they, you know, the FTC or DOJ needs X many more staff members, but they also need... money for experts. And that was, it was actually kind of funny when I ran the agency as the acting chairman, it was just me and Terrell McSweeney. And we had a lot of cases in active litigation. A lot of expert money was needed. And we were able to sort of shift funds around because we weren't paying for the other commissioners and their offices. So it helped us in that regard. But I mean, once the commission's fully staffed up again, right, that expert money is gone. So just as someone who actually had to start saying, like, you know, can we challenge this merger? Is there enough, you know, money in the budget to do it? That's just a very practical kind of suggestion.
Michael?
Yeah, so when I was a baby lawyer, which I guess I can't claim to be anymore, I came to the commission shortly after Staples, and so I learned how to do merger litigation from George Carey and Rich Parker. Right, and on market definition, what they said is, don't worry about market definition. Like, there was a big argument internally, do you do market definition, do you not? And they were like, look, you put in your best evidence, and then you say it defines the market, and then you could do the market shares, and then you win. And that is like a classic maneuver by a trial attorney. You would think 30 years later, the court, people would have realized that unilateral effects shouldn't require market definition. And yet, so we have now put the government in this bizarre place that if they want to bring a case on unilateral effects, or if they want to go after potential competition, or if they want to go after eliminating a maverick, they are stuck sort of doing this they have to get the market share presumption, because on the other side, the market share presumption, we should stop calling it the market share presumption, because it's not a presumption. It is just a necessary element. I don't know when the last time the government has won a case without proving the presumption. That's not a presumption. That's just an element of your case, and it's not even sufficient anymore. So one thing we need, if we're not going to sort of go the Fiona route, which that would be first option for me, is we need either through the courts or Congress to identify that there, whatever the other presumptions, and ideally make them real presumptions, and by flipping the burden. And so one of the things I find most troubling about merger enforcement in the United States is since 2015 until recently, neither the federal agencies had lost a merger case, right? And some people take from that, they're like, oh, well, the law must not be disfavorable to the government because the government's always winning. And some people said it shows that the government's just not being aggressive enough because they're not making enough cases, bringing enough cases because you should be losing some. I have a sort of different take, right? When cases go to litigation, they go because the two sides have drastically different views of the expected outcome. That's going to be driven by the cost of the litigation, the probability of winning, and the value. And so if the government's winning a bunch of cases, it means the value to the companies of winning those cases were such that it overwhelmed whatever they thought the probabilities were. Because you should assume that over time that both sides should have a roughly understand where the law is. And so that should be problematic, because what we have is the government having to litigate cases that, as Bill Baer said, never should have got out of the court boardroom. And that means there are a whole bunch of other cases flowing by that are anti-competitive. And until you change the deterrence level, you're going to have significant under-enforcement.
We only have a few minutes left, and let me ask a question that I haven't told you I was going to ask, but and give you a just. Let me start with Fiona, since she's been the most dealing with the public and the press here, I think, recently. Why now? Why are we having this agitation about, you know, competition policy, bigness, and all of that?
I think it's because of widening income inequality. I think if you look at the markets that people buy in, seeds, you know, all the agricultural inputs, milk, hogs, chickens, turkeys, if you look at cable, if you look at cell phones, if you look at drugs, if you look at hospitals, you know, that's anti-competitive mergers and anti-competitive conduct raise prices in those markets. And what does that do? It transfers money from consumers to stockholders. And the stock market keeps going up, and people say, isn't that marvelous? It's a sign of the health of the economy. And I think it's actually a sign of the fact that both regulation and antitrust are letting companies make more profit at the expense of consumers. So I think fundamentally there's a deep dissatisfaction, and it's showing up in populism. And that's partly because we're doing things like with the Amex decision, directly transferring money from cash-paying customers, to Amex cardholders. And Amex cardholders are right at the top of the income distribution, and cash-paying patients are consumers are at the bottom. And if you thought about wireless, it's the same thing. Let's move the prepaid people and give them higher prices, and let this, you know, the stock price, the stocks be held by people in this room, and they'll benefit. So I think antitrust is carried out by elites, for elites, and it's not working for the rest of the country, and I think that's why we have this problem. And you know, I am an elite too, so I'm sure I'm making mistakes, but I feel like we're really not introspecting enough about that.
Maureen?
Well, I think it's coming from several sources. I think one is the fact that we're hearing a lot about the tech industry. And I think that the tech industry has disrupted a lot of interests that are not happy about that, right? And one of those interests is, I think, is the news media itself. So they are maybe not realizing that the lens through which they're seeing it maybe has some self-interest there. And so I think we're hearing a lot of drumbeat about that. I think one of the other things is, you talk about elites. I also think, you know, and this was a big focus of mine when I was the chair, and Tim, I know you also had focused on these issues, which is for the average just sort of worker bee person, occupational licensing now has become such a pervasive requirement in the U.S. economy. So back in the 50s, only about 5% of jobs, and these are jobs on the bottom end of the economic ladder. People are trying to, you know, make their way and climb up the economic ladder. Now it's between 25 and 30% of people. So they may not necessarily say, oh, you know, it's all due to antitrust policy, but they may be thinking, you know, populist reasons, like, the system is rigged against me. If I'm not already connected, I can't get through that door. So I think paying attention to those issues and the like increasing role of, you know, the regulatory burdens of starting a business or growing your business or becoming a hair braider or a tree trimmer or, you know, what have you, are things that we, it's not the only problem, but I do think it is part of what is animating these populist concerns.
Michael?
And thank you for calling me on last so I could think the longest. So I agree with Fiona. I think income and wealth inequality is a big driver for why there is this sort of populism and anger. Of course, I work for the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, so we're kind of focused on equity. But I also think, right, this is part of a larger story. And, right, it's, I think similar things are occurring in consumer protection issues, in the environmental realm, is that there's a sense that playing within the system was what we tried in the 90s and what we tried in the 2000s, and it didn't work. And the left's response is increasingly blow it up and do something big. And, you know, I think the right has, is also sort of blow it up and do something different. I think they haven't figured out they want to do different things, but, you know, that's their issue. And I think that's one of the reasons why, as someone who believes in antitrust enforcement, you know, devoted his life to it, is to not act now, we may end up with something far less attractive in the future.
Bill?
I'd throw another cause on the table, and it's the collapse in 2008, and I think we still taste the residue of that. I think it did two things. One is it destroyed public confidence in markets in many respects, especially the dispossessed. It was a tremendous shift in fortunes there, and that's a lasting source of disbelief in the efficacy of markets, not just in the U.S., but in many other countries. And it created a sense of discomfort and disbelief in the competence of government. That is, how did this happen? How were so many financial services regulators blind to what was taking place? How was it that in so many instances there were bland assurances that it's all figured out, it's worked, the risk is taken care of, and then it happened. So two blows. One is a great degree of discontent with markets and a great deal of disbelief in the efficacy of government and public intervention. I think we're still living with that, which opens up the door for a lot of questioning about what's taken place. And I think it really puts a lot of pressure on public institutions to rethink things. And I think in many ways, it's a good time to have a conversation about how risk-preferring you should be. That is, how do we measure the real effectiveness of the public institutions? Win-loss rates, not so much. Actual impact on economic progress, hard to do. But what should we be looking at in order to measure what happens? And last, I think it's going to provoke much more attention to the question of how good are the institutions entrusted with making policy, and how do they do that kind of work, and a more sober-minded understanding of what it takes. That's why I go back to my billion a year and why I do that. To go to legislators and say, for example, in the way that George Marshall did in 1947-48, the way that Congress did with Apollo, and say, it's going to be really expensive, it's worth doing. But if you try to get broadband policy results with dial-up institutions, you will fail. And I saw that movie in the 1970s, and that's what antitrust did.
Well, let's give these excellent panelists a